Welcome to Mad or Bad.
My name is Rachel.
And I'm Neil.
Today we are bringing you the story of Niels Hogel, a German nurse and serial killer estimated to have murdered between 100 and 200 of his patients over the span of 5 years. This fascinating case leaves as many questions unanswered as it does victims in its path. How did Hogel get away with murdering his patients for so long? And why would a nurse, the epitome of care and compassion, seek to murder in the first place?
Hogel was born on December the 20th, 1972, and raised in the German coastal town of Wilmshaven, I believe it's pronounced, Lower Saxony. Hogel comes from a nursing family. Both a grandmother and his father worked as nurses. His father formerly been employed at the St. Wilhard Hospital in Wilmshaven. Hogel decided early on in life to follow in his father's footsteps to train as a nurse. According to Hogel, he had a sheltered or protected childhood and was not exposed to violence at home in any way. He grew up in a strong Catholic family and described this as warm and stable. Talking to his former teachers and classmates, Hogel was described as friendly, helpful and fun. A news source quoted another person who grew up with him, stating he was in no way someone from the fringes. There was nothing remarkable at all about him, just an ordinary young man. At age 16, Hogel began training to become a nurse at the main hospital based in his hometown. Which is quite early, isn't it?
I don't know how the educational system works.
18 in the UK, isn't it, the earliest? I don't know. He failed to make a strong impression, but colleagues and superiors remember him as being nice during the few years he spent there.
The nice guy facade soon began to shatter when Hogel was working as a nurse at a hospital in the northern city of Oldenburg. He started working here in 1999. The hospital had a very good reputation. However, Hogel at this time felt quite overwhelmed by his work in the cardiac surgery intensive care unit and started drinking heavily as he sank deeper and deeper into a depression spiked by his own feelings of low self-worth and self-esteem. In August of 2001, doctors and medical orderlies of the hospital ward 211 began discussing an unusual spike in both reanimations and deaths during the preceding months. I think reanimations, that's kind of a German term
when someone's dying or whatever, kind of flatlined or whatever?
Yeah, and they bring them back. I think it might be like a direct translation.
Yeah.
But I can't think of a word better to describe it, so yeah. Hey-ho.
His thing was trying to get him back from the...
Yeah, so lots of cardiac arrests were happening, lots of deaths during those months that he started in August of 2001. So Hogel himself attended the aforementioned meeting. They had a meeting to discuss basically all of this stuff happening in the hospital. Most of
Have we aforementioned the meeting? Were you mentioning it? Ah, that's okay. Go on.
Okay. Most of the attempted reanimations and deaths were found to have occurred while Hogel was on duty. Hogel began to gain a reputation as something of a jinx, and colleagues sought to avoid working with him.
I mean, you would, wouldn't you? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think jinx as tech is sort of a...
Yeah, but also, I was also one of those nurses who was called a bit of a jinx while I worked on acute.
Oh,
Christ. But I swear I wasn't killing anyone.
No.
It really was bad luck.
I'm glad you. Yeah.
But people did not want to work with me for a while. Oh, well, I kept finding people on the brink of death.
Well, that's how it goes sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, it was just bad luck.
So after the meeting, he called in sick for the duration of 3 weeks. I mean, he could have been sick, but... maybe he wasn't.
Maybe he was just trying to get away.
So during that time, only two patients in Ward 211 died. Which, you know, it might sound like, you know, only two, but it was a cardiac ward, wasn't it? So I guess, you know.
Cardiac and intensive care.
Right, you know. So intensive care, so obviously, yeah. So with only two patients dying, that was significantly fewer than had died prior to his sick leave. Statistically, 58% of all deaths at the hospital occurred when Hogle was on duty, which in itself is...
says it all.
Yeah, you know, that's it's either very unlucky or something going on. So, under pressure by the cardiac surgery's head physician, Hogle was transferred to the anesthesiology ward in 2001. I bet anesthesiology ward were really happy with that, weren't they?
Sounds like a barrel of laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I've never heard of an anesthesiology ward.
No,
actually.
Obviously we've heard of anesthesiology, but an actual ward. Do they have? What do they do? Do they just?
Oh, do you know what it is?
What?
That's when it's like an ICU ward, but with ventilated patients. Actually.
Oh right. So
it's all the people who are under ventilation, because it's actually the anaesthetics team who take care.
They're not in ICU then, they go to...
Well, it's an ICU, but it would probably be just a special ward for only people who were ventilated. Because it's usually the anaesthetics team that are in charge of their care. Because obviously the main factors with the person is the kind of the level of anaesthetic that they need. And they look, obviously they look at the airway, and that's, you know, they manage that, Neil. Mm. They manage the airway.
Excellent.
So that's probably what that was.
The ward's head physician soon became suspicious of Hogle, as the latter was frequently present in emergency situations. So kind of quite soon after he came there, there were suspicions arose. So in September 2002, the Oldenburg Clinic's head physician pressured Hogle to resign from his position at the hospital after multiple patients under Hogle's care had been found in life-threatening condition. For at that time, inexplicable reasons. It was suggested he either resign and continue to receive full wages for another 3 months, or transfer to the hospital's logistics unit where he would assist moving patients throughout the hospital.
It's pretty poor, though, that they're just like, okay, look, there's something going on.
We won't investigate
it. We're not going to look into it. We're not going to ask questions. You know, just resign, or look, we'll even pay you for 3 months full wage. Yeah. Just go somewhere else, please.
It's appalling, isn't it?
That is bad. That's really bad. And I mean, you know what? We're reading this and I'm kind of almost thinking it's back in the like 80s or like 70s, but no.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this was only, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah, in Germany. It's not like some, you know.
It's crazy.
A third world country or something. So, on 10th of October 2002, he actually received a reference letter issued by the Oldenburg Clinic's Director of Nursing. Therein, she testifies to Hogle's circumspect, diligent and autonomous work ethic, as well as him having acted prudently in an objectively correct manner in critical situations. I mean, I guess... In a way,
he technically did, though. He technically did act in these critical situations. Well, he was the one, probably.
He was kind of making the critical situations, wasn't he? So, he was having a lot of practice. She also praises his devotedness and cooperative conduct. The letter also concludes with an overall assessment of Hogle having completed assigned tasks to the utmost satisfaction.
It's just a way of getting them out as soon as possible.
Yeah, I mean,
these people have a responsibility to protect their patients,
absolutely,
protect the general public, and they did none of that. Actually just let him continue for years.
It's appalling, isn't it?
It's appalling. Yeah, it's really bad. So in December of 2002, Hogle transferred to Kliniken Delmenhorst Hospital, where the emergencies and fatalities continued to occur, mostly when Hogle was on duty. Surprise, surprise. Within the first 4 months, a patient, Brigitte A., died under his care. Others, Hans S., Christoph K.,
Super
and
Hans.
Joseph Z., followed. Neil, these are people who've died.
I know, no, it's just, I know, absolutely.
I'm going to cut that.
No, don't cut that.
The deaths were mainly due to arrhythmias or sudden decreases in blood pressure.
Would you like to just describe, Rachel, with your vast physical healthcare experience?
An arrhythmia? It's just when...
I mean, I know, obviously, but I'm just asking you to.
Don't worry, Neil, I'll tell you.
You teach me, yeah.
So basically, when the heart pumps, it's and normally... your normal pulse is called sinus rhythm, but there are lots of different conditions where you have an arrhythmia, which just means that the rhythm of the heart is not normal, but it can cause things like strokes or clots, so it can be potentially quite dangerous.
Thanks, Rach. Carry on.
So this led to some of his co-workers distancing themselves from Hogel. Off duty, Hogel rode along in an ambulance operated by the German Red Cross station. Hogel proceeded to live a fairly normal life outside of work and actually married in 2004, going on to have his first daughter in the same year.
He probably was involved in the birth, wasn't he? Probably instigated, you know, kind of sped the labour up at home. Wanted to be involved in that as well.
Jumped in on that as well. So he was allowed to continue this carnage in this neighbouring town where he practised, even though colleagues had now nicknamed him Resuscitation Rambo.
So what exactly was Hogel doing to his patients? Hogel was administering a fatal heart medication to his patients called...
Agmaline. I don't know. I've never heard of it.
People who are given an overdose of this medication might start to feel dizzy, may feel a flutter in their chest before they begin to struggle to breathe and eventually lose consciousness. One doctor described it as, if you're in the water and drowning, so...
As if you were in the water and drowning, yeah. Which sounds awful, doesn't it?
Yeah, dreadful. Ooh. The heart may stop or may not beat effectively enough to keep the person alive. Thus, the patient would require cardiopulmonary resuscitation, so CPR. CPR involves pressing heavily on the patient's chest in order to stimulate the heart to pump around the body. So the oxygen around the body.
Yeah, so you're pumping that blood around the body, you're keeping the person alive, basically.
This keeps the person alive until healthcare professionals can reverse the causes of the person losing consciousness. Many different tactics can be used to restart the heart, including doing a defib, or using a defib to shock the heart into returning to its normal rate and rhythm.
That's probably what you've seen on telly when they shock. You know, they have the two paddles.
And that's what...
like, clear! And then they shock.
Well, we don't actually use the paddles, do we? When we are training, we just use the defib and the two pads.
Yeah, it depends where you work, though.
But not paddles.
The paddles come with the monitor, which shows you the rhythm. So if you're a doctor and you know what you're doing, you can basically make a decision as to whether to shock the heart or not.
We're never trained with those, are we?
No, because we're mental health, obviously. We're not very... Well, we are. No, we're quite up on physical health. It's just we don't have that level of expertise.
Well, the defib that we use, you know how nowadays you see defibs, don't you, in old red telephone boxes and on walls and stuff like that. Well, that's just a defib that we've got, isn't it?
Yeah, like a community defib.
But it's more about reversible causes, isn't it, that we
And that defib, it basically... recognises if it needs to shock or not. Because there's only certain rhythms that are shockable anyway, so it might not be effective.
So even in hospital, CPR is not very effective and its success rate is 17 to 20%. However, that's kind of one in five, but without it, I mean, the patient's dead anyway, aren't they?
Well, yeah. So
I think community is even lower than that, isn't it? It's about 8 to 10%, something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, when you think about CPR as well, though, I'm sure both of us have been involved in CPR with patients, and you know, it's a really invasive procedure. It's not dignified by any means, especially if you have, you know, elderly patients that are quite small. They have brittle bones. You know, not to be too graphic, but you can break people's chest bones. It's not nice.
I once told you that story, didn't I? That this is some years ago. I was in sort of the nearest city towards Derby. Mm. And I was out shopping on my own. And I went around this corner. And anyone who knows Derby, St. Peter Street. And so kind of main shopping street, pedestrian area. And there was a chap that had collapsed on the floor. I didn't know him, obviously. And there was just kind of people standing around. And I'd been to... I've been to a record shop, CDs at the time. I'm now a vinyl snob, aren't I, Rachel? But it was CDs at the time. And I'd had them in a bag. I think it'd be to HMV. I had them on the... So I went down and see what was happening. And I had to kind of... people just kind of, I don't know if they're filming or just on the phones or I don't
know. Crowding around.
And so I started to do CPR and obviously got someone to ring 999. And by the time the paramedics came... And taking the gentleman away. I mean, sadly, he died, but I did my best. That's what
you
can
do. How did you know he died?
Because I had some contact. I mean, he didn't look good at the time, but I think...
Well, no, he was already dead.
I think there was some process of... I can't remember this, about 9 years, it was some kind of process of finding, I can't remember, or did I have to do a report on it after, or there was some, I can't exactly remember.
I feel you wouldn't know, they'd be whisked off and that would be the end of it.
I mean,
I
didn't have nurse's uniform on at the time, I wasn't aware, but I did tell them that I was a kind of nurse, and maybe, I can't really remember, yeah, you're probably right. But anyway, so all this had happened, and then I looked down and I had this big bag of CDs, and some fucker had nicked all my CDs. I mean, that's...
It's just shit. That is dying. Humanity, isn't it?
Fucking hell. Yeah. Anyway.
That is shite.
Anyway, I digress. But
I can't see anyone's ever nicked my CDs on the ward while doing CPR.
No.
But
terrible. General public. Thatcher's Britain.
I have no words. That's just that is shite. For Hogle, the thrill of grabbing the defib to make a dying patient's heart beat again was described by him actually in court as a kick. And when he succeeded in appearing calmly to save a person's life, it was like standing on a pedestal.
Was it like that for you in your career when you've, you know,
absolutely
said you've
had quite... not. Oh my God.
I mean, I'm joking.
I mean, I've never saved anyone, so maybe that's why.
You did your best. You did your best.
But you never felt like a hero.
No, I mean, I'm just...
Oh my God, it's scary horrible, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Like the adrenaline that you get from it, though. I mean, all I can remember, really, is my hands just shaking. Once you get into it, I think...
Yeah.
You tend to think really clearly of what needs to happen. I know that's my own experience.
Yeah.
But it is really nerve-wracking. And afterwards, you feel so exhausted because it's been such a rush. But I never felt like, that was a fabulous experience.
No,
because it's not.
I mean, I was joking.
Awful thing to be involved
Absolutely.
In. So in the first hospital he worked in, his colleagues even made him a necklace. And this necklace was made of catheters.
What?
I know. Well, I guess they just used whatever they could find.
Okay. So they thought he was a good fellow then, presumably.
I think so. I think it was a bit of a running
joke. And he was loving it, wasn't he?
Like
He's always there when this person,
And he's like this cardiac arrest champion.
Yeah. Resuscitation Rambo, wasn't it? That's what it's called, yeah. Resuscitation Rachel.
So Hogle even asked two female student nurses to come and watch him, clearly trying to impress them during one resuscitation attempt.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
just like...
What, did he just stop and say, come, surely,
just like, it's embarrassing, actually.
Well, yeah, a bit odd.
Ugh, he just sounds like a bit of a dope. Hogle quickly made a name for himself as someone who could handle the pressure of life and death situations. It appears Hogle was unsurprisingly not motivated by compassion. Some of his victims were conscious when he made his move, and in court he did describe one patient as a whale.
All right,
and in a later trial he stated that he thought the hyper-detached attitude of some of his superiors was cool.
Hogle's killing spree was stopped in 2005 when a nurse, Renate T, caught him in the act of administering unprescribed medication to a lung cancer patient named Dieter Meers.
Oh, that's a German name, isn't it? Dieter!
Life support system had been switched off, and in the rubbish lay... Rachel's put trash, but, you know... In the rubbish lay four empty vials of medication not prescribed for that particular patient. She quickly took a blood sample and sent it to the lab for tests. The next day, the patient was dead. When the test results showed a dangerously high level of heart medication, the doctor and nurse in charge met to discuss the situation. But they let Hogle finish his shift. Well, short staffing. In those hours, Renate Roper, 67, became Hogle's final victim.
So basically...
No, that's
her name.
Well,
She's
the nurse.
I can't help that the nurse and the patient has the same name.
Oh, okay, sorry about that, yeah.
It looks like between the hours of him killing that patient, Dieter, and them kind of, waiting for the blood test to come back, he actually ended up killing another patient, that 67-year-old lady.
Yeah, I mean... I don't know if, I was, like, at this point, he's worked at several different...
He's worked at two different hospitals.
Yeah, you'd think that, I don't know, did people not talk to each other? But again, I suppose you know, he got that really good reference, didn't he? And he just Resuscitation Rambo and all
you
this.
You know what, I read some interesting articles about, it was more the political side of why particularly in Germany people don't like to question other people. The culture does tend to be that people don't like to question other people. They don't like to make them uncomfortable.
So when police questioned him for the first time in 2005, Hogel proudly exclaimed during court that they didn't even ask him if he was drunk, despite Hogel stating that the whole room stank of booze. So it's quite sort of
that
open.
Sounds really narcissistic, though, as I was there and drunk and they didn't even realise I was drunk.
We'll come on to the...
It sounds like a twat.
So as of June 2019, Hogel has been involved in 3 separate trials for his killing spree. Hogel confessed to 55 murders and the court in Oldenburg convicted him of 85 in total. It is possible that Hogel has murdered many, many more. Authorities have since investigated hundreds more, which included exhuming the bodies of former patients in clinics where Hogel has worked previously. However, the number of victims may be even higher. During the 3-year investigation, more than 200 cases were re-evaluated. The 134 exhumed bodies were distributed across 67 different cemeteries. In many cases, decomposition had progressed too far to be able to detect any traces of medication. 101 patients from Delmenhorst, who died during Hogel's tenure, could not be autopsied as the remains had been cremated. In 2015, suspected victims were exhumed in Ganderkirse and Delmenhorst. The body's autopsies revealed traces of heart medication. I mean, I guess they would reveal traces of heart medication if they're on that, but I guess it depends to what level, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's just really difficult to draw any conclusions from that.
I'm not sure
any of that.
It's indicative of, but
in a way, though. I mean, I don't think any of that information
possibly
would be able to be brought to court.
No. Well, we don't know the levels of all medication, do we?
But basically, it indicates God only knows how many people he actually killed.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean,
it?
He was working as a nurse for like so many years, but on that killing spree for like 5 years.
I mean, it reminds me of, I mean, several true crime podcasts have covered this, and there's been books and documentaries. Beverly Allitt?
Yeah, I mean, classic
case. It was
Grantham
Hospital, wasn't it? I think that was early 90s. And I know,
There's been loads of different cases. There's been quite a few in Germany as well.
I'd never actually heard of this one, which obviously is one of the reasons why we're doing it. But yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of cases out there that mirror the same type of person doing that type of thing. It's quite interesting.
I mean, I think sometimes we forget, you know, as me and Rachel are both nurses, that we're in a very privileged position, you know, because we do it every day. You kind of just, you know, you get into the, you know, you go to work, you come home, but we're in a very privileged position and a position of trust. I mean, we've got access to, you know, a
wide range of different medications.
Absolutely, and you know,
and potentially, I mean, thankfully, most nurses are good people who don't want to cause any harm.
Well, yeah.
But the potential is there that actually, you know, you could really do whatever you wanted if you wanted to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
So I guess that comes into the factor of why is there so many nurse killers is actually they have
the means to
do it.
Yeah, there's the means. But when we say there's so many, well, if you, as a percentage wise of how many nurse killers, let's say, they are compared to how many nurses they are, then it would probably be very low, you know.
Yeah.
But it's the means, isn't it? And the position of trust and responsibility.
Yeah, definitely. So why did Hogel do it? Dr. Carol, I can't stop laughing at
Paul
this
Hines
name.
Bean, yeah. I'm
Hines
sure
Bean, and I swear that is the name. I did not
made,
make that up.
You made that up?
I can't go on calling
Maybe
him
it's
that.
Just us.
I'm just going to call him Dr. Carol.
Dr. Bean.
So Dr. Carol, a leading German neurologist and head of psychiatry at St. Marian Hospital in Ham, pointed to Hogel being motivated by a narcissism and a deep need to fill a lack of self-worth. In quotes, he says, Niels Hogel is a member of an extreme minority, but what struck him about his testimony was his lack of empathy, even when speaking to victims' families. However, there are differing opinions. Another psychiatrist, who was actually an expert witness, said during the trial that while Hogle had displayed traits of noticeable personality disorder, such as that lack of shame, guilt, lack of empathy, they were not so severe as to nullify his responsibility. So in other words, whilst Hogle has been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, it does not mean that he lacked competency and awareness surrounding the gravity of what he has done.
That's interesting, really, because I know in the areas that we were, assessing somebody's competency or
capacity
has been a real big drive, you know, quite rightly so, probably over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And we assess somebody's capacity on admission to hospital, don't we?
In relation to literally any decision that's made.
So
it could be, you know, admission to hospital. It could be in regards to medication. It could be in regards to going on to a placement. There's so, like, literally it is every single decision, and it's decision specific.
And there was an incident once, I know this has happened to a lot of mental health nurses, and nurses generally, sadly, but I know, I've been assaulted a couple of times at work, and there was one occasion, well, on both occasions, it's kind of, okay, they may have had a significant mental health diagnosis.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they haven't got the capacity to understand
what they're doing.
Well, they're still responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
That varies, of course, and it's assessed on an individual basis.
Yeah, and it's only applicable to that time as well.
Of course, yeah.
Because it can fluctuate, it can change.
Absolutely.
But it's an interesting topic, I think.
So, what is narcissistic personality disorder? Narcissistic personality disorder, one of several types of personality disorders, is a mental condition in which people have an inflated sense of their own importance.
Like you!
Well, I was looking at you, Rachel. A deep need for excessive attention and admiration, troubled relationships, and a lack of empathy for others.
What are you trying to say?
But behind this mask of extreme confidence lies a fragile self-esteem that's vulnerable to the slightest criticism.
So, a narcissistic personality disorder causes many problems in many different areas of life. You know, this can include relationships, work, school, financial affairs. People with narcissistic personality disorder may be generally quite unhappy and disappointed when they're not giving, you know, the special favours or not given that admiration that they believe that they deserve. They might find their relationships unfulfilling, and others may not enjoy being around them. There's so many different signs and symptoms of this personality disorder, and obviously the severity of that does differ depending on the person. But such things that we tend to see with this personality disorder are, as Neil has said, an exaggerated sense of self-importance, a sense of entitlement in requiring that constant excessive admiration, expecting to be recognised as superior even without those achievements that warrant it.
Gee, I've got a few people coming to mind already.
There's somebody that I actually know that I'm like, oh, he is checking all those boxes. Tends to exaggerate their achievements and talents. Quite preoccupied with fantasies about success, power, brilliance, beauty, or the perfect mate. Believes they are superior and can only associate with equally superior people.
Well, we all know people like that, don't we?
They tend to belittle or look down on people and perceive others as inferior. And sometimes they can take advantage of others to get what they want. They tend to have an inability or an unwillingness to recognise the needs and feelings of others. So again, that comes back to empathy. They can be quite envious of others and believe others envy them, which is kind of a weird thing that they envy others, but also
believe others envy them.
But again, it's down to that low self-worth. Also behaving in quite an arrogant or a cocky manner, coming across as conceited.
A haughty manner.
What does haughty mean?
Well, you know, cocky, sort of high.
Well, that's what I said, cocky.
No, I just saw haughty there. Anyway, go on.
Coming across as conceited, boastful, and pretentious. And they can insist on having the best of everything. For instance, the best car, the best office, the best house.
Yeah, I mean, and I know the ones that Rachel just listed there. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, everything.
All of them, no.
And to some degree, I think at we some all time, have. We can all...
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I don't tick many of them.
Oh,
at
no,
all.
You're so humble.
Well, you know, I try. But, you know, so it's if they're ticking these boxes consistently.
And it's, I think it's when it's getting to the point where it's actually causing an impact in their life. You know, it's causing an impact on the relationships or at work or at school or wherever it may be. That's when it's a disorder, really.
At the same time, people with narcissistic personality disorder have trouble handling anything they perceive as criticism, and they can become impatient or angry when they don't receive special treatment, have significant interpersonal problems and easily feel slighted. They can react with rage or contempt, again, I can think of, and try to belittle the other person to make themselves appear superior. They can have difficulty regulating emotions and behaviour. They can experience major problems dealing with stress and adapting to change. They can feel depressed and moody because they fall short of perfection. They can have secret feelings of insecurity, shame, vulnerability and humiliation. It's not known what causes narcissistic personality disorder. As with personality development and with other mental health disorders, the cause of narcissistic personality disorder is likely complex. Narcissistic personality disorder may be linked to the environment, mismatches in parent-child relationships with either excessive adoration or excessive criticism that is poorly attuned to the child's experience, genetics, so inherited characteristics, neurobiology, the connection between the brain and behaviour and thinking.
It's kind of all that stuff like between nature and nurture, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think so.
So narcissistic personality disorder affects more males than females. I always think that's something to do with hormones, actually, but I don't know if that's just...
I don't know what the research...
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see into that. It often begins in teens or early adulthood as
Again,
well.
Again, which may lead into your hormone
And kind of that development of the personality and all that kind of stuff. Some children may show traits of narcissism. This may simply just be typical of their age.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we all get those moody teenagers who think they know. I mean, I was definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Although I do always know better.
No, certainly. Yeah, absolutely.
So although the cause isn't, you know, perfectly known, some researchers think that it's that biology, it makes children vulnerable. There's that kind of interaction between parenting styles. So either parents that are very overprotective or parents that are, you know, kind of the complete opposite and quite poorly attuned to their children. And of course, you can't, you know, talk about personality disorder without mentioning genetics and neurobiology, which could also play quite an important role, I think, in the development of people's personalities.
In January 2018, the Oldenburg State Attorney's Office pressed charges against Hogel, accusing him of having murdered 100 patients between the 7th of February 2000 and the 24th of June 2005. Four separate charges that were jointly tried. The deceased were aged between 34 and 96 years old. The indictment stated that in his position as a nurse, Hogel had killed patients by administering the following substances or medication without medical indication. Potassium. How do you say that again?
Achmaline, I think.
Saltolol.
Lidocaine.
And?
Oh, I like saying this one. Amiodarone. I always think that rolls nicely off the tongue.
It's quite nice. The main trial at Langerichter, which is in Oldenburg, apparently, commenced on the 30th of October 2018. Sorry about my pronunciation. I mean, I'm not...
I think it's pretty good, actually. You're doing a better job than I would.
funnily enough, I'm not fluent in German.
Are you not?
No, just French.
And Schulagung.
Just French.
That's the only word I know. It's a great word, though.
It is. Due to the... That means excuse me, everybody. Every day's a school day. due to the high number of people involved in the trial, there were 120 joint plaintiffs, it was held in the Wesser Ems Hallen ballrooms.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Sounds scary in there.
It does, doesn't it? It's just the 2018 to 2019 court proceedings spanned a total of 24 days of trial. Out of the 100 murder charges, Hogel confessed to 43 on the first day. He stated... Conveniently, he could not recall 52 and denied his involvement in the five remaining deaths. Out of the 32 witnesses present at the trial, 8 testified under oath, Three testimonies were heard on camera. Four medical experts presented the court with detailed information on the causes of the patient's diseases as well as the effects of the medication administered by Hogel. Professor Staller, a forensic expert in testimony psychology, I've never heard of one of them, but...
Well, I guess he just looks at, well, the psychology of the
No, I know, but just a term. I mean, I get that, but just a testimony, he's a testimony psychologist.
He's probably the only anyway. One who is, that's why he's the expert.
Yeah, I guess. So he examined the truthfulness of Hogel's testimony. He concluded that Hogel, although in principle both capable and willing to lie or provide false testimony, had provided the court with truthful confessions.
Staller, I wonder how they reached that conclusion, though.
Yeah, it's...
Because you think, yeah, Hogel, he's really narcissistic. I think there probably is quite a high chance that he inflates the amount of murders. Mm. I mean, there's a possibility there, definitely.
There's a possibility.
I'd love to know how he made that.
Is that all down to this one Professor Staller, this testimony psychologist? I mean, it's a lot of...
I'm going to have to Google him.
It's a hell of a lot of responsibility there, isn't it? If it's just on one man. But anyway, I digress. So, Staller. Stella's a drink, isn't it?
He is Stella, though.
Stella saw no indications for a false confession. On the 6th of June 2019, the court in Oldenburg sentenced Hogel to life imprisonment.
Well, thank God for that.
Hallelujah. Taking prior convictions into account, the court determined Hogel's severe gravity of guilt, a German legal term which significantly increases the respective sentence's severity and precludes a chance of early release after potentially 15 years. So he could have just done 15 years. He was found guilty on 85 separate murder charges and not guilty on 15 further murder charges. As both Hogel and joint plaintiff have appealed the verdict, this is not yet final. So it's November 2019 now, and... I don't know, sometime next year?
Yeah, I guess. We'll see what happens. Surely he's not going anywhere after 15 years. You've got to be joking me.
I'm not having that.
Come off the stage.
Come on.
Revelations of apparent negligence by the hospital authorities have already led to other criminal investigations. Two doctors and two nurses from the Delmenhorst Hospital were charged with manslaughter. This trial has yet to go to court.
So that's additional to...
Yeah, because they did have a responsibility to say something and they didn't do anything.
Well, that's
and they left him there overnight. Hey-ho, go kill someone else then.
Crackers.
Off you go.
Crackers.
After the 2015 sentence became valid, both the Delmenhorst Clinic and the Oldenburg Clinic stated their intention to compensate the victim's relatives.
It's a bit late, isn't it, for that? Mm. Oh.
I mean, better late than never, well, I guess. In July 2015, both clinics announced their plans of being the first clinics in Germany to introduce a process termed qualified necropsy. I can't say that.
Necropsy. That's the one.
Involving an additional coroner. The introduction of this two-man rule aims at preventing unnatural causes of death owing to criminal actions going unnoticed.
So it's just kind of another sort of fail-safe...
Well, it's lessons learned and stuff, isn't it? So it's like they have to obviously change something because they're accountable now. It looks a bit bad if they don't change anything, does it?
So an additional coroner then. So basically you get like a second opinion.
I guess that's what it means. Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean,
at least... Which is fair enough.
Yeah. So that's it for this week's episode. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have done making it.
As always, please support us by liking and following us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/madorbad. If you really like us, you can leave us a review on Facebook.
You can also find us on Twitter @madorbadthepod. Thank you for listening.
See you next time.